Well, I never expected this many people on Sunday evening, I can tell you that. But I am glad that we have gotten casual and done away with coats and ties, aren't you? And Doug, I don't have a watch, so you and my wife tell me when. Yeah, but see, I told you this morning, I can't see that clock. No, I can't see that far. In fact, this is a blurry group in front of me here. Well, it's good to be with you. Thank you so much for inviting us. I've been to your church, I think, at least three or four other times. I can't remember. And I've always had a wonderful experience of being here and being with you and enjoying your worship. So tonight, if you'll turn over on the back to this computer-generated, I'm being facetious, y'all, this hand-drawing thing that I have. Everybody, so I think it's the second page, and at the top it says the origin of Baptist. Everybody with me? I am a very non-techie person. I'm too old to learn that stuff. I wish I knew it and wish I knew how to do it, but I don't. So we're going to have to go with this, and the crowd's too big for a chalkboard, so we're going to have to go with my sheet of paper here. First thing I want to do, though, is ask, how many of you have been members of this church for 50 years? Let's see your hands. All right, thank you. How many... Let's see, you're 44. Are there any charter members left? No? Well, there's one. Okay. How many of you have joined this church in the last 5 years? Wow, good group. And how many, keep your hands up for just a minute. How many of you who have joined this church in the last 5 years come from non-Baptist denominations? What denomination? Oh, Methodist. I saved my wife from Methodism, I told you. Assemblies of God. Presbyterian. Over here on this side. Eastern Orthodox. Good. I've got you on my map tonight. Yes. Methodist. Methodist. Anybody else? See, I can't see. Presbyterian. Okay. All right. Well, good. That helps me to know sort of what has happened here. I thought it was important. Well, no, let me ask you one other question before I start. If this is on rollers here, isn't it? If you went downtown Birmingham, and you were standing on a street corner with a sheet of paper, and you asked the first 25 people who came by, what do you think of when you think of Baptist? What do you think of when you think of Baptist? Tell me what you think they would say. Fundamentalist, okay? Evangelical. Immersion. Once saved, always saved. I'm sorry, you're talking too much now. No, you're not. Tell me what. Foot washers. Ah, there are Baptist foot washers. I'm sorry? Don't dance. I wondered if somebody was going to. My wife taught me to dance, but she was a Methodist, so, you know. And I, at the time, I was nothing. I was in about the eighth grade, and Kay and I got to know each other, and we've been with each other ever since. So, anything else? What do you think people would say? Primitive. I'm sorry, primitive. Boy, none of that sounds too good to me. Some of it sounds good, but some of it's very negative, isn't it? Teetotaler, which of course is not true. Hadn't been true for a long time. Well, that is an interesting image. coming from this church. That is so much of what you said, not the doctrinal ideas, but much of what you said about fundamentalist, no dance, all of that seems to be so strange to me in Baptist churches like yours. So I want to begin tonight by talking about where Baptists stand in the entire Christian tradition and how we got some of our ideas. So this little handout talks about the origin of Baptists. I can't stay here long, because if I do, I won't get to the fragile freedoms. But I think it's important for you to see this as a kind of historical development. So let me begin by, let's go to 1054. You see that line there? Up until 1054, the Christian church was dominated by the Roman Catholic Church. Now, there's an interesting question. When did the old Catholic Church, the universal Church of Christ, become the Roman Catholic Church? When did that happen? Well, the way you answer that question is by asking another question. When did the Bishop of Rome come to dominate all of the other priests in the church and bishops? Historians answer that question in very different ways. Of course, Catholics say in the New Testament. But Protestant historians, for the most part, will say it happened somewhere around 400 or 500. Some will push it back as much as 600. I think by 400, there is something in the Western tradition that we can call the Roman Catholic Church. Now, you know a little bit about the Roman Catholic Church, so I'm not going to talk about it very much. But do you see the break in 1054 there on your sheet? And there becomes the Eastern Orthodox Church. Part of the reason for the break from the Roman Catholic Church by the Eastern Orthodox Church was the preeminence of the Pope. There were lots of other factors that went into it. But you and I mostly don't know very much about Eastern Orthodox. Where we grew up in the Delta of Mississippi, there was no Orthodox church. I'm sure you have Orthodox churches in Birmingham. And in most larger cities you do. But in most of the little towns that Baptists grew up in the South, they may have had a Roman Catholic church, but they didn't have an Eastern Orthodox church. So we don't know much about them, but it's a very, very interesting group. Is that me? No. Okay. Eastern Orthodox Church has similarities with the Catholic Church, but it has differences. I take a whole semester talking about this when I was teaching, so we've got to run. Look at 1500, and you will see the break of the Protestants from the Roman Catholic Church. Eastern Orthodox Church continues to this very day. Roman Catholic Church continues to this very day. And Protestant Christianity continues. But Protestant Christianity emerged in several different groups. The first was the Lutheran, Martin Luther, October 31, 1517, nailing of this 95 theses to the cathedral door, started the Reformation. And then there popped up different kinds of Protestants. One of the major forms of Protestantism that has had enormous influence on Baptists is the Reformed group. The Reformed really means Calvinist. So anytime you see the word evangelical and Reformed or Christian Reformed, it usually refers to John Calvin's theology. You usually think of predestination, but there was a lot more to it than that. There was a group that broke off from the the Lutherans and the Reformed call the Anabaptists. That's A-N-A. It's not A-N-T-I. A-N-A. It means rebaptizers. And the Anabaptists were people that rebaptized folk who'd come out of the Catholic tradition. I need to pause and back up. From the Lutherans, we Baptists got a good bit of stuff. We got the priesthood of all believers. We got sola scriptura, scripture alone. We got the idea that there could be no magistrate and no pope telling us what to do. From Calvinism, many Baptists don't think of themselves as Calvinists. But we have a strong influence of Calvinism in Baptist life in America. And it centers on the idea of the sovereignty of God and that God does the saving in Christian salvation. The Lutherans and the Reformed and the Anabaptist all occurred on the continent. Luther in Germany, the Reformed in Geneva and Switzerland, and then spread, and the Anabaptist in Switzerland. That's where they began. There was another phase of the Reformation. It occurred in England. It's called the Anglican Reformation. And it's from that Reformation that we will see Baptists come. You remember the story of Henry VIII and all of his wives. Henry broke with the church in England for years had been the Roman Catholic Church. But in 1534... Henry VIII broke with the Roman Catholic Church and established the king or the queen as the head of the church in England. That was the only major difference. In fact, Henry VIII defended many of the Roman Catholic ideas, but he wanted to be the head of the church in England. I've heard many Baptists come out of an Episcopal worship service and say, that seems like Roman Catholic to me. Well, the Episcopal Church and the Roman Church are close, as you well know. In fact, I don't know if you know this, but there are some Episcopal churches that are more high church than some Roman Catholic churches. I've preached in an Episcopal church before, where I thought my allergies were going to kill me because of the incense that they had in there. So you can get to Anglican churches that are very high church. But the Anglicans broke away from the Roman Catholic Church. There were a group of people who were dissatisfied that the Church of England didn't break further, make more reforms. Those people were called Puritans. They were people who wanted to purify the Church of England more than it had been done under Henry VIII. You see that I have them in parentheses there? The reason is there never became a Puritan denomination. The Puritans were people who stayed in the Church of England but wanted to purify the church. You with me? There was a group, however, of Puritans who became more radical. And they said, no, the Church of England is a completely false church. And they have not separated from Roman Catholicism enough. So they pulled out of the Church of England, and we call them separatist. You see it on your outline there? From the separatist came some denominations that you would be aware of. The Congregationalist. Do you have many congregational churches here? It's interesting that in the South we don't have many congregational churches, but we're talking about the people who settled New England. These are the people that you and I know from our history as Puritans. They came here and they were Congregationalists. very close to Baptist in many ways, in many ideas. And then also from the Separatists came the Quakers. What do you know about the Quakers?
They don't talk.
They don't have to pay a preacher, do they? What else do you know about them? Nonviolence, pacifist, yes. They're wonderful people. As a group, they're wonderful people. My wife says I should join them for the silence. I'm not going to do it. In fact, I probably should have Congregationalists, and the next line should be Baptist, and the next line should be Quakers, but that would have messed up my diagram, so I didn't do it that way. But then comes the Baptist from the Separatist. And would you believe that we Baptists began in two groups? You would believe that, wouldn't you? I mean, it's, you know, we have about 80 different groups of Baptists in America today. We just multiply and separate from each other. But we began with two different groups. One of them was called General Baptist because they believed that the atonement of Jesus Christ on the cross was for everybody. It was general. By the way, they didn't believe in once saved, always saved either. What does that sound like to you? It sounds like Methodist, my wife said. That's a little bit of what it's like. These are sort of Methodist Baptists that are emerging here very early on. On the other side of the particular Baptist, these people believe that the atonement was particular. It was for only the elect. What does that sound like? Sounds like Calvinism and Presbyterianism. We started in two different theological groups. There was some difference in culture and class as well, but basically these two groups. So, from the Catholics, from the Catholic Church, the larger tradition, there is no such thing as a Baptist idea of God. There is no such thing as a Baptist idea of the Bible as a source of authority. We got our ideas about sin and salvation from the larger Catholic Church. From the Lutherans, we got the priesthood of believers, the idea that you're saved by grace alone, and that kind of thing. From the Reformed, we got the emphasis upon the sovereignty of God. We didn't get much from the Quakers. By the way, a lot of the early Quakers came out of the Baptist. And I'll show you that in just a moment. So what are Baptists reacting against? They're reacting against the domination of religion by the state. Because when the Protestants began in 1500, there was no idea anywhere about religious liberty. The church and the state came on the same plate, and it was all scrambled up. There was no separation. There was no religious freedom. You had to believe what your state believed because there were state churches. Churches that taxed other people, discriminated against other people, if you didn't abide by the state church. Do you know when the last state church was disestablished in this country? In 1833. We had in this country state churches until just about 100 years before I was born. This idea that people came to this country for religious liberty, don't you believe it? They came here to establish state churches like they wanted. So what you had in New England were the Puritans who would eventually chase Roger Williams out of town. And he would go to Rhode Island. But I get ahead of myself. Look at the bottom of your page. The top part of it is a little bit about the history. The bottom part of the page is what I've called the spiritual movement of the Reformation. Look on the right-hand side, and there is Roman Catholicism. I have it on the right side because the Roman Catholic Church was the conservative church in the 16th century. You understand? They don't want change. What did they believe? They believed in the sacraments. They believed in the clerical priesthood. They believed in a central authority. They believed in a state church. They had bishops. And they taught something about salvation by works. Move across just a little bit and you run into Anglicans. And the Anglicans, as I said a moment ago, broke away from the Catholic Church, but they still have some of the things very similar to the Catholic Church. Move a little bit to the left. And what you're seeing is a movement away from Catholicism in Protestantism. And so you have the Lutherans. The Lutherans still have some of the elements of Catholicism. I once asked a Lutheran preacher who came to our church one night to speak. I said, if you had to leave the Lutheran church and join another church, what church would you join? He said, the Roman Catholic. Just like that. So there are some Lutherans who are close to the Roman church. Most of them are not, by the way. You move a little further and you get to the Reformed Church and you see the religious movement moving away. Then you get to Congregationalists. What did they believe? They believed that the congregation was responsible for the life of the church, not a bishop, not a magistrate, not anybody in the state. And so they're moving even further away than Lutherans. Lutherans have bishops, you know. And so they have that left over from Catholic Church. Then you get to the Baptist, and we'll talk about them more explicitly in a moment. But look at the Quakers on the left end. This represents the extreme of the Reformation. And so what did they believe? They don't have any sacraments. They don't baptize. Every time they commune together at dinner, they have the Lord's Supper. They are getting as far away from Catholicism as you can get. They had no priesthood. Most Quakers have no preachers. There are some Quakers who do. But the Quaker movement wanted to level the playing field, and they wanted to do away with the priesthood. They wanted to do away with the authority of the clergy, and they placed it in the hands of the people. And they placed a great emphasis upon what they called the inner light, which is the Holy Spirit within the individual that leads the group. They had no bishops. They believe, of course, in grace alone. Let me stop there. How have I confused you? What questions do you have about this? And if I tell you I can't answer that right now, see me after we get through. It's because I can't answer that right now. Yes. Yeah. The leader of the Quakers was a man by the name of George Fox in this country. And you know what they did? It is very similar to the charismatic movement in this country. Do you know that term, what I'm talking about? Charismatic movement. Many people came out of Baptist churches, Methodist churches, Presbyterian churches. A lot of them came out of Catholic churches because they had the experience of the Holy Spirit and the gift of tongues, they said. Those people just started meeting in small groups. No one was in charge. And they met together for Bible study and worship and so forth. Quakers were very much the same way. Yes. No, but that's a really good question, and I should have said something about it. Go back up to the Mennonites, the Anabaptist. You see the Anabaptist up there, right under the Reform? In parentheses, I've got Mennonites. Mennonites are the most numerous expression of Anabaptist. The Amish are Anabaptist. They're the most conservative Anabaptist. There are some Anabaptist churches, by the way, that are very similar to Baptist. I did a study very similar to this to a church with a church in Virginia, in Harrisonburg, Virginia. And the pastor lived right across the street from a very large church. And I asked him what kind of church it was, and he said it's a Mennonite church. It's an Anabaptist church. So I walked over there one day, and I picked up their order of worship. It didn't look like yours this morning, but it looked like the church I grew up in that was very simple. It had about three hymns and two prayers and a place for preaching. But my friend, who was the pastor, Baptist pastor there, said that Baptists in that region often move toward the Anabaptist. But Baptists don't come from Anabaptist. They have some similarities to them. Baptists come from the separatist. Do you see that distinction there? Other question. All right, now this is going to be on the test, y'all. Okay. Let's turn then to the first page of the first sheet. It's called An Introduction to Baptist. Now, keep in mind the diagram, the fact that Baptists came from the separatists, who came from the Anglicans, who came from the Catholics. Got it? So Baptists weren't just reacting to Roman Catholicism. Baptists were reacting to Anglicanism. But they weren't just reacting to Anglicanism. They were reacting to Lutheranism and the Reform movement. So what Baptists were trying to do is to create what they called the pure church and the true church. And they thought the Anglican church and some of the others were, they used harsh language, y'all. Some of the language they used about some of their brothers and sisters in Christ was not the language I used this morning in talking about these churches that are like yours that are Christian churches. Some of them didn't think those churches were Christian. The two men that sort of founded Baptist life are known as John Smith. By the way, can you think of a more ordinary name to found a movement? John Smith and Thomas Helways. That's a little bit different. And many of you would know that there is a publishing company in Macon, Georgia, our hometown, called Smith and Helwys. It's named after these founders of Baptist life. John Smith was a graduate of Cambridge University. He was an Anglican priest. He was well educated. And so when they say something about us as being uneducated, tell them about old John Smith. He was well educated. Had some of the best education England could offer. But what was happening was this movement was occurring from Roman Catholicism to Anglicanism and finally to separatism, and people were getting further and further away from the characteristics of Catholicism and Anglicanism. So John Smith, an Anglican priest, became what was in essence a Baptist minister. But in 1606, by the way, dates are not that important. All you do use dates for is to hang something on them. So you don't have to memorize the dates. That's not going to be on the test. But you do need to know. There will be a test, y'all, before this is over. 1606 is the first important date. And that's the date in which a separatist congregation started meeting in a little place called Gainsborough, England. Kay and I went to Gainsborough one time when we were in England, and visited the little place where allegedly Smith and Hellwood started this Baptist movement. But they were separatists here. What do I mean by separatist? They were not yet Baptist in the sense that they had adopted believers' baptism. They had all been baptized as infants in the Anglican Church. And while they had rejected much of Anglicanism, they had not rejected the idea of baptism. But they're moving. And they are also being discriminated against and even persecuted. 1603. James VI of Scotland became James I of England. And you know him why? Because of the King James Version of the Bible in 1611. And when James came to be the King of England, the Puritans and the Separatists thought, oh my, this is wonderful. He's coming from a Protestant place. He's going to be Protestant. And James came in and said, look, no king, no bishop, not at all. You will either conform to the Church of England or I will drive you out of the land. You know, do you remember when the swarming of the Puritans and the Pilgrims came into this country? It was in the 1620s, while he was the King of England. At the same time, John Smith and Thomas Helwes had this little separatist congregation in Gainsborough. They were suffering some discrimination, some persecution, so they left and they went to Holland. Holland, in the 17th century, Holland was the place where everybody went who wanted religious liberty because there was more religious freedom there than anywhere else. So Smith and Helwes go to Holland. They have the, by the way, their little church traveled with them, 25 people or so. Helwes, I didn't tell you, Helwes was probably a lawyer. He apparently came from money. And it is believed that he financed the whole group to go to Holland. So they went to Holland, and they established this little separatist congregation. But John Smith became more and more agonized over the issue of baptism. And he thought, you know, the New Testament doesn't teach anything about baptizing infants. So in 1609... he got his group together, and he said, we need to make more reform. We need to have believers' baptism. That means you had to be able to believe in order to be baptized. They had all been baptized as infants. And so John Smith baptized himself by taking a pitcher of water and pouring it on his head. Not by immersion, but by pouring water on his head. There are three types of baptism. One is sprinkling. That's what we know the most of probably in this country with other Protestant denominations. One is pouring, and there are still groups that pour. And the other one, of course, is dipping, immersion. John the Baptist was John the Dipper. And we Baptists are dippers. So, but at this point in 1609, these people were not baptizing themselves by immersion. They were concerned with who was being baptized. Now, this is very important because what they wanted was a believer's church. They wanted the freedom to say that the only people who can come into our membership are those who voluntarily choose without any coercion, without any pressure on them from the state or from another church or from their family. They have to make the decision themselves. That was basic to what they were saying. And when I talk about the Baptists being free, I'm beginning right here by saying they meant they were free to believe. And that nobody could force them to believe. You know, there's some words you can't put together. You can put together forced labor. Or you can put together forced obedience. But there's nobody in the world that can put together forced love. You can make people be obedient. You can't force them to love. And what John Smith was saying is that we want a church where people choose to love the Lord Christ and voluntarily accept Him as the Lord of their lives. Did any of you see the movie The Apostle with Robert Duvall? It's a great movie, by the way. Go home to Netflix and watch it. It's one of the best religious movies Hollywood's ever produced, in my judgment. It's got some good violence in it, you know. But that's part of what makes it religious, by the way. But Robert Duvall is the apostle. And he's given up on everything in the church. And so one day he just wades out into a lake and goes down into the water and baptizes himself by immersion and comes up. John Smith did exactly the same thing, except he poured rather than immersed himself in the pool. So what are they looking for, these Baptists? They're looking for a believer's church. Let's see where we are here. Many historians, many Baptist historians would say this is the first Baptist church in 1609. Others would say, no, you got to wait till immersion comes along. But I think it's important for Baptists today to understand that what Baptists, earliest Baptists were interested in was not the form of baptism. What they were most interested in was the person being baptized, because they wanted that person to choose the faith. I remember walking through the Dallas airport one day, and I saw this lady coming at me, and she had on the sweatshirt, and on the front of it, it said, "Make up your own mind." And I stopped her, and I said, "You must be a Baptist." She looked at me like I was crazy and went on. But if that's what the early Baptists were saying. Make up your own mind. This is too important to let somebody else make it up for you. This is too important to leave it to somebody else. So the family can't do it. The church can't do it. You have to do it. Becoming a Christian is a voluntary matter. Now, this created all kinds of problems for Baptists, and it still does. For example, what do you do as a Baptist church when someone comes in who's already a believer, but not by immersion? Do you accept their baptism, or do you require immersion? What do you do as a church when someone comes in who says that they are believers, committed Christians, but they were baptized as an infant? The earliest Baptist, some of the earliest Baptists, not all of them, but some of the earliest Baptists, accepted these people. Later on, Baptists became much more restricted, as many of you know, and would have nothing but immersion. But let me ask you this question. Does believers' baptism, that is to say, baptism that somebody chooses, does that guarantee, by immersion, does that guarantee a believer's church? I'm sure I baptized. In fact, I can't tell you one of the stories in my life where I baptized a guy in Lake Chico in Lake Village, Arkansas. I can't tell you what he said when he came out of that lake. I mean, it was cold. It was October. And when he came up, I mean, he let me know about it. I don't think he was quite saved completely. I can tell you that. Well, those are issues that Baptists face. How do Baptists answer those questions? In every way you can imagine. Why do they answer those questions in every way you can imagine? I'm asking you a question.
They made up their own mind.
They made up their own mind, but also every Baptist church can do what it wants to. Just like the individual makes up its mind, the local church makes up its mind. My guess is you have probably different approaches to this from many Baptist churches in Birmingham. And if you checked with different Baptist churches, you would see they're all over the board in answering these questions. Now, we have talked about believers' church. Baptist wanted a believers' church. I have always wished, Doug, that we had chosen another word. I wish we had chosen the word followers. We want a followers' church. Because baptism, you know, that can be easy. Following day after day after day, that's where it hits the road. So I know what we mean by a believers' church. I believe in it. But I wish it were a followers' church. I want to read you something. I don't think I put it in your handout, but maybe I did. I don't think I did. Let me read you something. This is about the importance of people saying yes for themselves and affirming faith for themselves rather than somebody else doing it for them. Freedom from domination. Freedom to live one's own spiritual life. Freedom to seek the highest truth, unabashed by any human pressure or any collective demand. The ability to say one's own yes and one's own no, and not merely to echo the yes and no of the state or of the party or of the corporation or of the system. This is inseparable from authentic religion. It is one of the deepest and most fundamental needs of humans, perhaps the deepest and most crucial need of the human person. For without recognizing the challenge of this need to say yes or no for yourself, no human can truly be a person. And therefore, without it, one cannot fully be a complete person. A Baptist could have written that. The person who wrote it was Thomas Merton, one of the greatest Roman Catholic mystics who lived in this country in the 20th century. I have always been intrigued by watching people in other denominations come around to talk about the importance of people saying yes and no for themselves. Martin Marty is the preeminent church historian in this country. He taught at the University of Chicago for a number of years. And a few years back, in an article he wrote, he said, Baptistification, that's a good word, isn't it? Baptistification has taken over in America. What did he mean? He meant that more and more people were recognizing that the most important thing that one can do in the religious life is to say yes for yourself, to choose faith for yourself, to follow for yourself. So, a believer's church. This is also a church that is free to govern their own affairs. Can you find that on your bulletin there? A church free to govern their own affairs. I have in my little Four Fragile Freedoms book there this statement. Well, I'm at the wrong place. Church freedom is the historic Baptist affirmation that local churches are free under the lordship of Christ to determine their membership and leadership, to order their worship and work, to ordain whom they perceive as gifted for ministry, male or female, and to participate in the larger body of Christ, of whose unity and mission Baptists are proudly a part. There are three types of church government that you probably are completely aware of. One is the Episcopal. If I had a chalkboard, I'd draw a circle. And in the middle of it, I'd put one dot. And that dot represents the bishop. Because in Episcopal church government, the bishop has more authority than anybody else. What are some churches that have bishops? Methodist, Episcopal, Catholic, Orthodox, my brother back there. You know, there are some African American churches that have bishops. They call them bishops, but they're not really bishops. They're just trying to take on a good name. I've always wanted to be a bishop, but Baptists wouldn't let me be that, see? But an Episcopal church government is a church that has much of its authority vested in a bishop. Second circle. Big circle, and then a smaller circle right in the middle of it. That's called Presbyterian church government. Because the Presbyterian church is more like the Baptist in some ways, but it has a smaller circle within the larger circle called the elders and the presbytery that sort of lead the life of the church. The third circle, you draw a circle, and in it you just put as many dots as you can. And that's called mobocracy. That's Baptist church government. But it means that every dot has a vote. Every person has a voice. That is called congregational church government. By the way, there is no such thing as the Baptist church. And I say that because in the last few years, I've started seeing in Baptist periodicals that term, the Baptist church. There's no such thing as the Baptist church. There's the Methodist church, and there's the Presbyterian church, and there's the Catholic Church and the Episcopal Church, but there is no the Baptist Church. There are Baptist churches. We don't have a central government anywhere that organizes or runs our churches. So the church is free to govern its own affairs. Why did Baptists come to congregational church government? How did they get there? Well, I think part of it is because they really believed that people had to choose their own faith. And so when they got in the church, they were responsible for their own faith, voicing their own faith. And also, Baptists were moving away from the authority of the clergy. And so Baptist life is placed in the hands of the laity. Are you aware of that, Doug?
Yeah, I think in about 3 minutes, the ladies will want to pray.
You're not dominating us, are you? All right, good. But what one of the things about Baptist life is that we're all priests. That's what the priesthood of believers means for us. And I've often thought that one of the things Baptists ought to do at least once a year we ought to all wear collars, priestly collars, to church, and then go out to eat at these cafeterias. And when people say, "What are you crazy people?" we can say we're the priesthood of all believers, because that's who we are.